I guess some people from the Occupy event that's happening right now at Westside Park will be over at about 1. Might have some alternative radio on at noon, hopefully. There's a fresh one in the box here. But right now, turn it over to the Labor Hour, who are in full fet share today. I think that's a word, isn't it? Thanks for listening, and keep a song in your heart. I don't know where that came from.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the December 10th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. Views and opinions expressed during this hour program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed or underemployed helpline, call 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who has some workers' interest news for us later in the show. The Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled Bring Back the Middle Class. And here with us today is also Bob Plesney, our co-host and technical advisor, and some special Labor Hour co-host from Florida, Jason Kozlowski, and special guest Dave P. We'll see if Bill Gorell is going to be coming on the show today. But anyway, here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Boeing Aircraft's Machinists Union voted Wednesday on a four-year contract extension that would ensure a long stretch of elusive labor peace as the new version of the 737 aircraft is built in Washington State. The union announced last week that it had reached a deal following secret talks with company bigwigs. If workers are ratifying the union pact, the machinists say they will drop their National Labor Relations Board complaint over Boeing's decision to open a non-union plant in South Carolina, in spite of the fact that the relationship between the Boeing company and the union's 28,000 workers in Washington State and Oregon and Kansas has been contentious, to say the least. Aerospace analyst Wayne Plucker says that Defense Department cuts mean that Boeing's commercial planes division will be especially important over the next several years, and a quiet stretch of labor peace is just what the company needs.
Verizon unleashed another salvo in the company's six-month battle against its unionized workers, firing 40 East Coast workers over the weekend for picket line activity during August's two-week strike. Communication workers and electrical workers, IBEW, say they will fight the firings and filed labor board charges. Unions represent 45,000 Verizon workers in the Northeast. Almost $1 billion in givebacks from the company remain on the table despite the strike. Verizon profited $22.5 billion since 2007 and relies on union members to maintain the copper network that moves both landline and wireless calls. Among the fired was John Collarin, the chief steward in IBEW Local 2222 in Boston. He said the firings are an attempt to decapitate union leadership, singling out stewards and executive board members, saying, quote, "This is retaliation and retribution for all the years these leaders have been speaking out for other members. They're trying to scare people, and they want to use us as pawns." Fired workers believe the company waited until now to fire them in an attempt to use them as leverage to lure the unions into accepting major concessions. Verizon is demanding thousands of dollars per worker in higher health costs, destruction of the pension plan, and unlimited contracting out. Bargaining has been stalled since members returned to work in late August, and the firings are seen as a bid to demoralize members and force the union's hand on takeaways. Union members say Verizon's scab managers and security guards sometimes hit strikers as they drove through the picket lines and on two occasions picked fights. David Cohen, a retired rep for United Electric Workers and an expert on strike settlements, said that under the well-established prohibition of quote-unquote disparate treatment and discipline, management can't single out union members if non-strikers are behaving similarly. The company can't fire a worker who used profanity while retaining a manager who did the same, but the fired workers have no recourse to an arbitrator. In a move that left many members upset, the unions signed back-to-work agreement in the wake of the strike that didn't include arbitration rights for at least 88 members, Verizon suspended for picket line actions. CWA officials later reported on conference calls with members that two-thirds of those suspended were eventually reinstated. All those now-fired CWA strikers received $300 a week plus COBRA health coverage from the union strike fund. Fired IBEW strikers without a strike fund to rely on have received support from fellow union members at Verizon, along with unemployment benefits. Bob?
Thanks, Jason. Excellent story there.
Mm-hmm.
Facing stalling growth prospects around the globe, Citigroup's chief executive, Vikram S. Pandit, that's Pandit with a P, not
B.
Not a B. We've laughed about this in the past. He said on Tuesday that the bank would lay off 4,500 workers in the coming months. Citi will also take a $400 million charge in the fourth quarter to cover the severance and other costs related to the downsizing effort, which will reduce the bank's workforce by about 2% to 262,500 employees. Citi now has roughly 100,000 fewer employees than it did at the end of 2007 before the worst of the financial crisis hit. Most of the job losses will come from Citi's back office and investment banking operations. Its Wall Street-related business has been hard hit by a slowdown in trading volume amid the turmoil in Europe, but nearly every part of Citi's sprawling businesses will face cuts. Citigroup is the latest big bank to announce extensive layoffs following similar actions by many of its rivals that have coursed through the industry since last fall. While Citi quietly began pruning its workforce this summer, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Bank of New York Mellon, and almost every large European bank have announced big job cuts. Wall Street companies have come under intense pressure as the world economy has slowed in recent months, and their once lucrative trading businesses have sputtered as investors have parked their cash on the sidelines. More traditional banking has also been hit hard by anemic demand for loans, as well as new regulations and consumer outcry against fees on checking accounts, debit cards, and credit cards. Dave?
Okay. Holding white carnations high above their heads to symbolize the nation's millions of jobless workers, including the 6 million facing the loss of their unemployment insurance benefits December 31st, more than 2,000 union faith and community activists committed their faith in action to demand Congress act now to extend the emergency lifeline for the jobless. At the prayer vigil with the Capitol Dome rising in the background, the Reverend Dr. Paul Sherry, director of the Washington, D.C. Office of Interfaith Worker Justice, offered the opening invocation and prayer. We are one people united in our goal here to bring justice and mercy to all people. And today, in your presence, Lord, we do believe we will prevail and ask that you give us the commitment to stand with them every day. The crowd included a large contingent from the Take Back the Capitol action on the National Mall, who marched up Constitution Avenue to the vigil with banners and signs that read, "This is economic emergency. We need jobs now, and we are the 99%.
According to Champaign County Nursing Home Manager Michael Scavato, two major checks are apparently on their way to the cash-strapped facility. Scavato, who is president of the Management Performance Associates, the St. Louis firm that manages the nursing home, remarked that we're going to get all the money that is owed to us. County board members announced last week that a long-due federal intergovernmental transfer was on its way to the county. That reimbursement, estimated at between $1.8 and $1.9 million, dates back to last June. Another approximately $500,000 will be paid in future quarterly payments. Meanwhile, the nursing home is also expected to receive another overdue payment, this one from the state government, in the coming week. According to Scavato, the nursing home is in line for $895,000 from the state government. Those reimbursement checks will be used to pay off an accumulation of bills at the nursing home that totaled $3,376,000 as of October the 1st.
Okay, we got an urgent news update here from Bill Gorell.
Breaking news. Anyway, folks, I just, since I'm late, of course, I went by Westside Park on the way into town, and there was maybe about 25 people, I think, heading over to, are they going to Chase Bank?
Yes.
Again?
Yes.
Okay, to the big bank, the Chase Bank. So if you want to get in and have your say, demonstrate, as you might say, your thinking on this, then head to the Chase Bank right now, downtown.
11 a.m., they start Occupy CU, started at Westside Park, and they got a rally, a speak out, and a performance showcase to kick off Occupy CU's Move Your Money campaign, and as Bill said, they are marching from Westside Park to Chase Bank.
And that's on the corner of University and Randolph.
Correct.
Back to the news. Wisconsin teachers are feeling the pinch as the consequences of Governor Scott Walker's anti-union bill are setting in. Some are facing 11-hour workdays and reduction in sick leave as school boards unilaterally set punitive new standards. Education budget cuts of $1.6 billion eliminated about 4,000 teaching and support positions statewide. Teachers' unions are reaching out to parents and grandparents to stress the impact the layoffs will have on students. Christina Bray, a spokeswoman for the Wisconsin Education Association Council, noted that elements of the law's implementation, such as what specifically constitutes collective bargaining, are yet unclear, saying the legislation was created that way to keep everything in chaos. Instability is something that this administration has thrived on when it comes to public workers. Now many school districts are imposing new employee handbooks on teachers in place of contracts, unilaterally establishing more onerous working conditions. Teachers in the Milwaukee suburb of New Berlin have been organizing against a handbook that was implemented without teacher input at the beginning of the school year. It includes provisions for a workday as long as 11 hours, elimination of preparation periods during the day, and additional training after work without compensation. The handbook eliminated a sick leave bank in which members pooled extra days to aid stricken colleagues, such as those with cancer who'd run out of their own sick days. Staffer Stephen Coopery said the district is hurting people at their greatest time of need. The school district called the teachers' mobilizations in resistance to this union bullying, and board members complained that the union bought outsiders to bring to the meeting.
Thugs. A new report came out this week on Thursday, a comprehensive new study that profiles 265 consistently profitable Fortune 500 companies finds that 68 of them paid no state corporate income tax in at least one of the last 3 years, and 20 of them averaged a tax rate of zero or less during the 2008 to 2010 period. These are among the findings in corporate tax dodging in the 50 states 2008 to 2010, and that was released on Thursday by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP, and Citizens for Tax Justice, CTJ. Our report shows that these corporations raked in a combined $1.33 trillion in profits in the last 3 years, and far too many have managed to shelter half or more of their profits from the state taxes, said Matthew Gardner, executive director at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy and the report's co-author. They're so busy avoiding taxes, it's no wonder they're not creating any new jobs. Among the 20 corporations who paid zero or less in state corporate income taxes over the three-year period are utility provider Pepco Holdings out of Washington, D.C., pharmaceutical giant Baxter International out of Illinois, chemical maker DuPont in Delaware, and fast food behemoth Yum Brands in Kentucky, and high-tech manufacturer Intel in California. Corporate tax dodging in the 50 states 2008 to 2010 concludes that these 265 corporations cost states $42.7 billion in lost revenues in the last 3 years.
Wow. Quite revealing there. Up in the remote mountains of West Papua, Indonesia, a road winds along steep cliffs, tall trees, and security checkpoints to the world's richest copper and gold mine. Adding to the isolation, the American mining company Phoenix-based Freeport McMoRan rarely allows visitors to enter the facilities. Yet, despite its cover, Freeport's giant Grasberg mine is on high alert. Production there has ground to a near halt as 8,000 workers strike for better wages, currently set between $1.50 and $3 an hour. Now in its third month, this strike is not only the longest in Indonesian mining history, but also one of the more violent, with deadly attacks on striking workers. The strikers have good reason to be wary for their safety. Freeport is paying millions of dollars directly to police officers who guard the mine, although the Indonesian police force has a history of brutality and corruption. Freeport has given $79 million to police and military forces in the past 10 years, according to a group called Indonesian Corruption Watch. Tom?
The Postal Processing Center in Champaign could be getting additional mail that is currently being processed in Bloomington if planned cuts by the U.S. Postal Service announced last week do in fact take place. The Postal Service announced it is moving forward with plans to slash its budget by $3 billion by closing more than 250 mail processing centers around the country, including 9 in Illinois. The cuts announced will slow first-class mail service, ending next-day delivery of stamp letters. The list of processing centers to be closed that was released earlier this year includes postal facilities in Bloomington, Carbondale, Centralia, Chicago, Effingham, Fox Valley, Quincy, Rockford, and Springfield. According to Beverly Howard, Customer Relations Coordinator for the Central Illinois District of the U.S. Postal Service, a final decision on specific cuts will be made at the Postal Service's headquarters in Washington, D.C. early next year. If the proposed cuts are approved, mail presently processed at the Bloomington Mail Processing Center would be divided between Champaign and Peoria postal processing centers, possibly creating a few jobs in both areas.
On December 7th, the Manitowoc Company announced it would replace 200 striking members of the International Association of Machinists Lodge 516 in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. The use of scab replacement workers has been relatively rare over the last 40 years in Wisconsin, a state with a strong union history, but in almost every instance, including the 9-year Kohler strike in nearby Sheboygan in the 1950s and 60s, the introduction of replacement workers triggered long and bitterly divisive struggles that shook the communities for prolonged periods. Determined to bring the weight of the Wisconsin labor movement into the battle early on, the Wisconsin AFL-CIO is planning a mass rally in support of the machinists on Saturday, today, December 10th. Negotiations over a new contract to replace the one that expired October 31st have been proceeding relatively well until Manitowoc Company unveiled a last-minute proposal to take away the union shop provision in the contract. With the corporation unwilling to budge, the IAM voted 180-2 to strike, and the walkout began November 15th. While there was agreement on many issues, the company proposed new language toward the end of the negotiations that was absolutely unacceptable, said IAM District 10 Business Representative Benito Elizondo. The company proposed eliminating long-standing contract language requiring any employee who benefits from negotiated wages and benefits to become a member of the union that negotiated those benefits. The company has also talked about requiring a union certification vote every year. Walker included a similar requirement for public unions in his budget legislation. The company's earnings grew in the third quarter of 2011 as the Manitowoc Company reported sales of $935 million in its food service and cranes operating groups for the third quarter, including a 20% increase in crane sales. Bob.
All right. In a story that we've reported on previously here, the owner of the West Virginia coal mine, where a fiery explosion killed 29 miners last year, has agreed to pay a record $209 million in compensation and fines, officials said on Tuesday. But the financial settlement does not stop other investigations into the disaster at the Upper Big Branch mine. The settlement stops federal prosecutors from pursuing any criminal charges against Alpha Natural Resources, the company that acquired the mine owner's Massey Energy Company in June. But inquiries into individual criminal liability are ongoing, and the agreement does not bar prosecutors from pursuing criminal charges against individuals, according to U.S. Attorney R. Booth Goodwin in Charleston, West Virginia. No individuals are off the hook, Goodwin said. The financial settlement includes $46.5 million in criminal restitution to families of the 29 miners who died and to two others who were injured. Each will receive $1.5 million, which is half the amount Massey had offered when it sought to settle with families immediately after the blast, according to the Associated Press. Alpha also agreed to invest at least $80 million in mine safety enhancements at its underground mines, to place $48 million in a trust fund to research advanced mine safety, and to pay up to $34.8 million in penalties to the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration.
Okay, stay tuned for some workers independent news.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Union-represented podiatrists are fighting for fairness in the way they're paid for podiatric care. It's an issue that impacts access to podiatric care for working people who often work physical jobs and therefore need more foot care. OPEIU Guild 45 President Dr. John Mariachi.
The OPIU, we were the first ones that started independent union or guild to represent physicians, and I believe that the clout and the legislative exposure of having a union behind us gives us some strength and ability to get our thoughts to the table.
OPEIU podiatrists want equal treatment and respect when it comes to the way the managed care health system treats them. OPEIU supports proposed legislation in Congress that would make it easier for low-income people to get foot care under Medicaid. OPEIU President Mike Goodwin says the bill, H.R. 3364, would also save the government money through preventative care. Americans United for Change has launched the Romney Gecko 2012 presidential ticket with a video called Morning on Wall Street. Spokesperson Lauren Wiener.
Romney has a long history of job killing in the private sector, and we think that that needs a lot of attention, and so we're going to try to do that with this campaign.
You can check out the Greed is Good Romney Gecko ticket at romneygecko.com.
And under the leadership of Mitt Romney and Gordon Gecko, the 1% will be richer, stronger, and better off. Even if the rest of us are unemployed, homeless, and hungry. It's morning again on Wall Street.
The Obama administration is the first to use federal spending to apply affirmative action to help workers with disabilities. Jesse Russell has more.
The Obama administration is seeking to increase the number of disabled people receiving jobs through federal contracts. The unemployment rate for disabled workers is substantially higher than the national average at 13%. The goal of the new administration rule would be to see disabled workers accounting for 7% of the employees hired by federal contractors. This would be the first time an administration has used federal spending to apply affirmative action for individuals with disabilities. The rule would place specific requirements on contractors that would encourage an increased hiring of workers with disabilities. However, the rule does not require contractors meet quotas. Before the rule is approved, it will be open for public comment for 60 days. Depending on the results of those comments, it could be activated as early as February.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company.
In November's elections, the national media gave extensive coverage to a proposed personhood amendment to Mississippi's state constitution. This extremist anti-abortion ballot initiative declared that a person's life begins not at birth, but at the very instant that a sperm meets the egg. However, extending full personhood to two-cell zygotes was too far out even for many of Mississippi's right-wing zealots, so the proposition was voted down. Meanwhile, the national media paid no attention to another personhood vote that took place on that same day. This was a referendum in Missoula, Montana, on a concept even more bizarre than declaring zygotes to be persons with full citizenship rights. It was a vote on overturning last year's democracy-killing decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the now infamous Citizens United case. A narrow 5-man majority of the court had decreed that abracadabra, lifeless, soulless corporations are henceforth persons with human political rights. Moreover, said the five, these tongueless entities must be allowed to speak by dumping unlimited sums of their corporate cash into our election campaigns, thus giving them a far bigger voice than us real-life persons. Missoulians, of course, cannot single-handedly overrule the Supremes, but they can be in the forefront of a grassroots movement demanding a constitutional amendment to reverse the court's perverse ruling. And that's just what Missoulians did, with a whopping 75% of voters calling on Congress to send such an amendment to the states for prompt ratification. This is Jim Hightower saying, hey, we can all be Missoulians. People in California, Colorado, Maine, Vermont, Wisconsin, and elsewhere are pushing such resolutions. For information on how to get your city and state to join in this call, go to wethepeoplecampaign.org/toolkit.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
We now come to that portion of the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week, Bring Back the Middle Class.
When the rich are allowed to rule, they're just like your bullies in school. Bigger ones are the worst of all, the ones who make the weakest fall. They are the snakes of the playground who by their treachery are bound. Our playground of society is full of impropriety. Big businesses and crooked banks are bullying the lower ranks. Illegal wars are letting up, but we still need more in our cup. Our bullies are the billionaires who push the small ones down the stairs, who lie and cheat and steal from us, forcing us to the back of the bus. There are the rich, there are the poor, there is no middle anymore. It's time the lucky ones gave back a bigger portion of their stack. Finance the middle class again. It is a conflict we can win, as long as we stand together in spite of inclement weather. When all the rich their taxes pay, it will darken our brightest day. It will brighten our darkest day. The middle class will run the show because the richest had to go. The poorest class should be no more because our nation is not poor. Bring Back the Middle Class was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on December 4th, 2011 and was brought to you live today, December 10th, 2011 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Some public service announcements. Right now, Occupy Champaign-Urbana is having a rally that's starting in Westside Park at 11 a.m. and it's going to be going heading down to Chase Bank in the corner of University and Randolph shortly. Their main action today is to picket outside the bank to basically convince depositors to take their money out of Chase and put it into a local bank or even better, a credit union. Also in Occupy Champaign, Occupy News, you are invited to join a December 12th day of action in Champaign-Urbana to highlight community struggles in our local neighborhoods and show solidarity with West Coast port workers and Occupy movements. Coordinated public presence and actions throughout Champaign-Urbana. We are inviting you to be visible at noon and 5 with your organizations, communities, families, and friends to show community power and solidarity with West Coast port workers and Occupy movements. This is a reimagining of street corner protests. You're invited to occupy your corner to help create a townwide presence. If you can't come out at noon and 5, then come out when you can. And they just advocating that you stand outside with signs at a heavy traffic intersection in your neighborhood, knowing that people all over town are doing the same. And the goal is to show solidarity with the West Coast port shutdowns, energize our local community struggles, make our community power visible, and create welcoming, accessible spaces. Highlight our connected movements for generational economic equality. And as a way of documenting this action, we'll ask that folks at each intersection send a photo or some video footage.
Yeah, folks, I would very much strongly urge you to start making these things. Because I'm going to tell you right now, man, yeah, I don't want to be like a wet blanket here, but when I only see like about 25 people, you know, walking out of that park to go to that bank, you know, I'm really disappointed. You know, what is there, like 100,000 people around here easy? Are you all so satisfied with the way things are going that you don't see much point in being in standing up and participating in this? Now, there, part of this may be the problem of Occupy Champaign itself not getting the word out good enough. But if you're listening to this and you're not in the hospital or something, you know, I'd hope to see you at the bank after the show.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. That was very appropriately said. And just some more public service announcements. On November 29th, the Illinois Education Association Teachers and Support Staff Union Board of Directors officially endorsed the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement's goals of economic equality and justice clearly align with the goals of IEA, and our 132,000 members, said IEA President Cinda Klickna. And also, check out Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday on Comcast Channel 6 from 4 to 5 p.m. And this Sunday is going to be a special from Labor Beat in Chicago, Holding LaSalle Street Bridge. As part of national actions on November 17th, several thousand mostly labor activists marched from the Thompson Center to briefly take over LaSalle Street Bridge in downtown Chicago. The police arrested 46 people who had sat down the bridge. Afterwards, the marchers went over to the Occupy Chicago site at Jackson and LaSalle in front of the Stock Exchange and then Board of Trade, actually. Then combined forces went on to other locations in the Loop. Check out this really interesting DVD this Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6. And anyway, we're going to hear a little bit of music here, and then we are going to come back and talk a little about the Occupy movement. So stay tuned.
They offered me the office, offered me the job. They said I better take anything they got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you want to be? Do you really want to be a job? Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job they offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. I hit the army. Opportunity, the one I never knock. Every job they offer used to kick you off the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knock.
Okay, that was The Clash, and we're now back with special guest Dave P. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Yeah, hey, thanks.
Okay, and so tell us about some of the reasons why you came down to Labor Hour today.
Well, they kind of announced the Occupy Champaign, one of the subcommittees, is going to have the Solidarity Neighborhood Picket of sorts to kind of think of it as a flying squad picket throughout Champaign and Urbana to support the West Coast workers, port workers that are going to shut down the ports that day. I mean, obviously, we're landlocked. We barely even got a pedal.
We got the boneyard.
Yeah. But, I guess Crystal Lake as well.
Okay.
I still forget about that. But that doesn't mean we can't do something to make, you know, an appearance and also show solidarity.
Okay. And so as far as this action that's going on today, you know, it's really, frankly, it's the least people can do. I mean, basically, if you've got money in a bank, one of the bailout baby big national corporate banks like Chase or Citibank or Wells Fargo, Bank of America, I mean, the least you can do is move your money out of that bank and put it in a credit union, or if there's no credit union in your area, into a local bank. And, you know, I don't want to belittle actions like that because, you know, a baby step's better than no step. And but where do you think we need to go from here, Dave? I mean, this is an interesting action, actually, about something that's happening all the way on the West Coast, actually here in the middle of the cornfields and the flatlands of central Illinois. I think it's really interesting. And I think, you know, that this might inspire maybe some more people to start doing, you know, taking up some local causes. What do you think?
Yeah, I would like to see that. I mean, of course, I speak for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
as we all do, yes.
Yeah. And I represent nobody but myself. Disclaimer. But there are interesting things happening with the Occupy movement, partially inspired by my friends, little anarchist kids, that, you know, this the general strike in Oakland. The shutdown of the ports where most of the goods that are made, like, say, by Nike in Indonesia or somewhere else in Asia for really low wages in sweatshops, that stuff is brought into these ports to be distributed throughout the United States. As well as there are elements of the Occupy movement on the West Coast and on the East Coast that have started to move families into foreclosed houses.
Yes.
I mean, this, you know, I mean, Occupying Park, that is a symbolic significance. But I personally, I think it's time to, like, take this notion of Occupy into direct confrontation with capitalism and the way our society works and disenfranchises people.
Yeah.
We can solve our own problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jason, I mean, you know, you're living down in Florida these days in the Tampa area. I understand there's been some actions down there in Orlando of doing some, you know, preventing foreclosures on people. And also, even back several years ago there, I believe there was an organization down in Miami. I think it was called Take Back the Land. Yeah. That were actually moving people into abandoned houses. Have you been seeing any of that in the local news down there at all? Or
not too much, although I am glad to say that one of the students that I had in this past semester in my theory of history class was one of the people who was involved in organizing these actions in Orlando and doing a lot of solidarity work around the things that I was assigning him to do in class. So I'm glad about that. And I think that what I am glad to see is in Tampa that there hasn't been as strident a sort of physical repression as I've seen in other places like in L.A. and elsewhere in Oakland, too. Mm-hmm. So there's been a consistent presence, especially in Tampa. What I am interested in, especially in the points that I think that Dave is making that are good points, is that it's worth thinking about that, especially in moving into some of these other actions and more with a broader social consciousness in direct application. This is occurring at a similar point in our current economic crisis in the way that some of these actions were occurring in the early 1930s after 2 and 3 years of deep depression. That is, you saw in the early 1930s similar grassroots movements prevent evictions from homes, and you saw actions in stores in order to prevent escalation of prices. You saw that is a direct application of pressure in order to prevent the worst in society. And I think that's something that is an interesting parallel here, that you have something going on at a time that speaks to just how deep this crisis is in addition to where it needs to go. I mean, this is really well over 3 years that we've had the worst of this that people are experiencing.
Dave, where have you've seen where a lot of this Occupy movement has either directly or indirectly, you know, through inspiration or whatever, gotten people to actually get involved in anti-foreclosure direct actions around the country? Do you know any places in particular where this has happened lately?
Well, in St. Louis, there's been occupations. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to tip that too much, but
oh, okay.
I know people that have occupied a whole city block.
Oh, cool.
Who have taken over a whole city block, and they live collectively in that city block. They farm their own food. They're trying to, like, effectively drop out of the system, basically. There are other examples of this. I mean, in Oakland, on the night of the general strike, an abandoned building was taken over by a group from Berkeley and Oakland that it was brutally repressed. It didn't last long. But at least these moments, I mean, if we kind of the way I've started to think about like these possibilities of the Occupy movement is that each city could be a bit of an incubator and a laboratory, and certain actions can be tried on a smaller scale, and ideally they'll spread. Look at how fast Zuccotti Park spread all over the country. What if General Strike in Oakland, now this introduces the whole, it was big news. I mean, it introduced the whole country into the idea of like, no, what about General Strike? You know, and it was symbolically successful. Also, these other things are occupying foreclosed homes or preventing evictions. There are lots of other, you know, I mean, going back to Italy in the 70s, you know, during Autonomia, one of the greatest, I think, things they accomplished was what they called the auto reduction, of where people organized, and it was largely women, housewives, as well as the male workers in the factories and students organized things like, we're not paying $200 heat bill this month. We're only paying $20. And you get 50% of your city to do that. What can they do? you know, the idea is to put direct pressure on these things that put pressure on your wages. We're in a period where, you know, for the past 30 years since evil master Ronald Reagan took over, of a decline in workers' quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So why not fight back? I mean, it has been class war for 30 years. The bad guys are winning.
Mm-hmm.
Because we haven't been fighting back. Maybe it's time we should
get
up and teach the schoolyard bully a lesson.
Yes, you know, it's interesting how quickly and brutally the police went into action when these anarchists out in Oakland took over an empty building. An empty building. You know, see, that to me signals that this is a real threat to the 1%.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing, too, and the mayor of Oakland, Kwan, spilt the beans on this. Department of Homeland Security and the FBI were in on organizing a lot of the crackdowns throughout the country.
In other words, they coordinated with all the mayors of these different cities, yes. They denied it at first, but...
Right, she spilt the beans. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, that's true. I was in on the compass call.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But, I mean, that's actually a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to be a little worried.
Yes.
And obviously they are a little worried.
Yes.
Make them more worried.
To quote,
make them scared.
To quote Wednesday Adams from the Adams family, be afraid, be very afraid.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're coming for your property and taking back our government too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, you also saw some similar things happening in Argentina back in, was it around 2000, 2001? 2002. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, people took over their you know, the take documents won. One event, but there, you know, there are many factories. They're like, at that time, there are about 400 fábricas recuperadas, they call them, recuperated factories, where the workers took over their shutdown workplace and ran it themselves. Now, this is one of the other strengths, I think, personal opinion, of the Occupy move that has potential. People are learning how to make decisions collectively,
mm-hmm.
democratically, without any bosses telling them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very, very powerful thing for Americans. We're incredibly obedient, more obedient than we should be. Talk about a beaten dog. But, you know.
They used to always try to say Germans were like that. And boy, I'll tell you what, being in modern Germany from the late 70s, the last time I was there around 99, Germans make us look like, they look like, anarchists compared to us.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem is that, you know, and this is all part of the being beaten down economically. It's all a part of the corporate propaganda, both through the news and our cultural entertainment. But that's the funny thing is this, all this that they've done so successfully for so well is starting to, is cracking. People aren't buying a lot of, most people are starting to wake up and not buying.
The spell is breaking.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yeah, but the German people, along with, most of the rest of Western Europe and Japan, have the legacy of having their constitutions and their societies set up by a New Deal democratic administration.
Back after the Second World War.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, the Marshall Plan. I mean, man, talk about a welfare thing right there. But the whole idea there was... Actually, the Republicans are trying to do this with Iraq. And the whole idea there was that the Truman administration, outgrowth of the FDR, was pushing. They were trying to make these countries into their model of what they wanted the United States to be before the Republicans took back Congress in 1946 and the entire Red Scare and everything kind of went off the rails. And currently right now, that was one of the things they were trying to do in Iraq, was that was going to be George W. Bush's Republican free market wet
dream.
That
was their laboratory for their economic wet dream. I mean, one way that we got to look at these things. I mean, what we're living in a period of social and economic violence against families, against children, against workers. You know, I mean, this is like serious stuff. They're going to cut off unemployment, and what is going to happen? Maybe they won't.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, they are threatening to cut off unemployment. I mean, the people there at this time, there are about six people for every job opening.
Mm-hmm.
How is this supposed to work? Like, okay, if they got a PhD in economics and they're so smart, then, like, what is the logic of that? I mean, yes, we know. The logic is more profit.
More profit and also making people more desperate to take even lower right. paying jobs.
And to take lower quality of life, take mm-hmm. lower everything, mm-hmm. you know. And so why do most Americans still see legitimacy in this system?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, effectively, we are in an abusive relationship.
You know, especially I mean, with the Democratic Party.
Right.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
No, really. Yeah.
Could be. But, you know, maybe it's time to, like, set fire to the bed. You know, you know, why not? You know, but
remember the Stockholm Syndrome comes from a standoff that took place in a bank.
I know.
Bank robbers.
Right.
Which basically is where the victim begins to actually sympathize
with the captor.
Yes, yes. Interesting.
Patty Hearst being the...
Yes. I want to read something here real quick that I found really interesting. It's from a man named Sean O'Terrain from suburban Chicago, and he's an Irish national from Northern Ireland, actually, from the area of Derry. And
he's not an illegal immigrant, is he?
No, he's not. But he's been on the Labor Hour before, and I thought this was really interesting, just to show you where the 1% is kind of trying.
You might want to be careful if he goes to Alabama.
Okay. All right. But anyway, where the 1%, what they're trying to do as far as they know this is coming. They've been seeing this coming for a while now, and here's what the 1% is trying to do to try to circumvent the people's will. He writes, here in the U.S. and Michigan and other states, the U.S. 1%, the bourgeoisie, are moving to replace elected representatives with financial dictators who can overrule all decisions and contracts in their effort to deal with deficits without hitting the rich and corporations. He's referring to is what they've done in Michigan, where the governor can appoint basically managers to basically go in, yes, and basically take over locally elected government. I mean, towns, you know, counties, cities.
Well, I think Detroit's on the verge of that right now. They're about ready to declare bankruptcy.
Yes, and he says, as far as I can see, a similar process is on the way in Europe, where in Greece, a fascist has been put in charge of the country's finances. He is now called a technocrat.
Yeah, technocrat.
Yeah, yes. And he goes, he goes on and mentions that the Occupy Wall Street movement is raising the issue of democracy in a general way as it highlights the 1%, 99% idea, and that the 1% owns the politicians and the political system. He goes, I believe the 1% bourgeoisie will push ahead with removing the elected representatives here in the U.S. in the towns, cities, and states, and try and force their cuts through in this way. In other words, more cuts, more austerity on us. He goes, I believe we will have mass uprisings as they do this. So he goes, they're talking about doing this in Detroit just now. And he goes, already they have done it in a number of Michigan cities, cities which include between them 50% of the African-American population of the state of Michigan. And he goes, activists should realize that democratic demands are a necessary part of their program. He says, of course, linked to the demands for an end to the dictatorship of capitalism. He says, in the small city where I live, there is a city council and every meeting is televised. He says there is never any protests or organized opposition or organized alternative to these events. He goes, this is going to be changing in other parts of the country and will, in my opinion, become part of the political life of towns and cities and states all over the country. We've already seen this in Wisconsin, Ohio. And he goes, this front should, of course, be linked to the mass direct action, helping people stay in their homes and preventing foreclosure and firings and cuts in wages and conditions. But I thought this was a really interesting statement, you know, because as we know, Dave, there's been kind of a, you know, on the left of the political spectrum, there's for, you know, God, going back decades and decades and decades, been kind of a rift between, actually probably over 100 years, a rift between people that are more considered Marxist and people that are more considered anarchist. And, you know, with this Occupy movement, I'm seeing a breakdown of that division, if you will. I'm seeing, you know, lots of collaboration going on here. I'm even seeing people starting to get into their traditional arguments, and then as soon as someone or even one of the people in the argument brings up that, you know, we need to focus on this occupation movement, move forward and put our differences and of opinion aside, it's amazing how it's such a great diffuser of the conflict. I mean,
victims need to gather together.
Yes, and
need
that's
to share their what they have to suffer.
And that's a good point, Tom, because that is one of the many ways that the ruling class has been able to dominate us for so long is alienation. Divide and alienation and divide and conquer.
Well, anyway, I mean, if you would get into to a lot of anarchist websites, and it used to be Anarchy Journal of Desire, yeah. Armed was a really good one. Their letters section, man, I mean, within anarchism, you have primitivist versus anarcho-cynic and so on and so forth. And there's always been a strain of anarcho-Marxism. And if you do look at Marxist theories, ultimately it would be an anarchist society. By the way, something I want to get in before the end of the show. We had a listener. This is Lori Solomon, a local photographer, mm-hmm. in fact, and a jazz buff. And he says, quote, "I think that one should be aware and note that on the air." And by the way, Doug Henwood has noted this, and Paul Muth played Doug Henwood's take on this 2 or 3 weeks ago. "I think that one should be aware and note on the air that recent reports that many smaller local banks and credit unions put their reserves and deposits in the big national banks or invest in many of the financial instruments, institutions, and corporate bonds and stocks, which the Occupy groups are now taking action against." And I'm going to add, your pension fund, if you have one, is probably doing that. Okay, yeah. Back to Lori. "Some of these small local banks, microbanks, and credit unions are subsidiaries of the big national financial institutions, which provided them their startup money as well as some of their operating costs." Yeah, those are facts, and thank you, Lori, for bringing that up. However, I do think you have to look at the, and I will say too, I have a small town bank, the Bank of BMet, and it used to be that they would kind of give me a few little breaks here and there, being a hometown guy. Now they're just, I mean, they might as well be in New York City. You know, that's just the way they act. So, but the thing is, this is more of a symbolic gesture, right. I would say. And it's especially good if you would go to a credit union, because when you would not be opening an account, you would be becoming a member with voting rights.
Yes, and also in conjunction with that, credit unions, unlike most of your commercial banks, whether large or small, on average, 70% of their deposits stay here with local investments, to homeowners, small businesses, you know, and only about 30% of their money goes into the various instruments nationwide. But nevertheless, as a member of a credit union, you do have a vote, and if enough people can belong to a certain credit union, they can make decisions on where to put the money. In other words, cut back on that
Here's
amount.
Here's an interesting notion that I ran into in Baltimore, and it's something that various people around the country have talked about before, but they implemented it. They have local currency. They have Baltimore has its own currency that you can use like dollars at participating local businesses, and I've got one in my wallet.
Yeah, and they're not the only place in the United States that does that either, but I cannot think of any other examples right now, but I have read quite a bit about these various, you know, movements
and
systems.
You know, and it's accepted just like regular dollars. And
wow, that's interesting. It almost looks like a European note.
Yeah, it looks better than our money. Yeah,
yeah. It's pretty.
But
it doesn't have a dead white guy on it.
It's Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass is on this Baltimore community currency. How interesting.
But I mean, most interestingly, it cannot be accumulated like dollars, i.e.
P.J. Proudhon would like that.
The only use it's for is exchange. And this is very similar to the voucher system that was implemented during the Spanish Civil War in local, like Madrid and Barcelona and in various other places, where money was abolished.
Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left right now. I do want to thank Lori Solomon for commenting on the show. And anybody who's a friend of mine on Facebook, if you're listening, send me a message or post on my wall during the show, and I hope I'll see it. And Dave, we got another show coming up right now. What's happening? The name of it? Who's on it? Whatever.
Well, I'm not sure. No one's informed me, but I believe it's the new Occupy Radio. I'm sorry?
Occupy Radio.
Occupy the Airwaves. Yes, indeed. We're so excited about this. I heard this was coming, but I didn't know it was today. So, we better get off here really quick then. We kind of got used to this.
You gotta play a song by The Clash.
I'm going to play a song by The Clash, and then also I'm going to play Patti Smith, People Have the Power. You've been listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour, broadcast from Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, and webcast live worldwide at weft.org. Thank you for tuning in, and tune in next week. Be safe, and power to the people.